Hi, Tim.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. I am Matthew Iglesias. I'm a fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, as well as a writer for some websites. And why don't you let people know who you are?
I'm Tim Carney. I'm the lobbying editor and a columnist at the Washington Examiner, and most recently the author of Obamanomics.
Exactly. Do you have a copy of the book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let me
hold it up. Let the people see it.
There we go.
Gotta get the plugs in. You know.
Good.
Sales are good. Yeah. So I think we're going to start out probably talking about healthcare. I think.
Sure. Sounds good.
Some latest machinations on that front. What's your assessment of the odds of this thing getting done?
I don't know. I don't feel like – I mean, this is mind reading, of course, so it's guesswork. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel like the Democrats really are serious anymore about passing anything. And I say this because I think the idea of price controls on health insurance premiums are such a crazy idea and so out of tune with what the Democrats have been doing so far. So I think a lot of this is an effort to sort of paint an us versus them picture going into the 2010 election. In other words, I think the Democrats are doing filibuster bait or something along those lines rather than
you're referring to the bill to give – they wrote a bill to give the Secretary of Health and Human Services authority to block rate increases. Right,
yes.
Right. So I think that that's true of that bill.
Mm-hmm.
And also of the I think they're serious about passing possibly the antitrust rescinding the antitrust status. But I mean, I agree with you that it's basically filibuster bait, that the idea is to get the House to pass that bill in anticipation that Republicans will block it.
Yes.
But Nancy Pelosi was out saying today that she believes she will be able to round up the vote she needs to move forward with the
mm-hmm.
main health reform package.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, is clearly not, you know, just for show.
Well, yeah, and I'm not into vote counting. Phil Klein and Ezra Klein and not related. What's his name at the Hill? Who's a Hill healthcare reporter? I'm thinking
Jeff Young.
Jeff Young. They're the ones who do the best vote counting. I follow them. So right
sure.
now, you know, I'll plead a little agnostic on the chances of it passing the House.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I did notice, let me bring up, I think
sure.
You linked to it, and I know John Chait linked to it, a Washington Post piece saying, oh, now in this now here's this final lobbying push. And up near
right.
the lead, Dan Egan summarizes – he's a Washington Post lobbying reporter. He
right.
summarizes the healthcare industry's efforts as lobbying to kill the bill. But then further down, when he actually quotes somebody – and there's no even
mm-hmm.
on-background quotes – when he actually quotes somebody, he has them saying, we're out there to educate, which of course means lobby, but we're out there to educate
right.
people on what is driving up healthcare prices. It's not insurers' profits. It's provider things. Now, obviously, an either-or is a silly thing. Both are driving
right.
it up. But so that shows to me that the lead in that Washington Post article that you and Chait linked to is a misleading lead. They're not right now trying to kill any sort of reform. As far as I can tell, what they're out trying to do is block this price control mechanism, this HHS empowerment. They want to kill that. That's specifically what they're talking about here. So the idea
I don't think that's right. I mean, obviously, you know, I don't know what reporting
mm-hmm.
it was that Dan Egan did. But you know, I mean, I do believe, you know, that he's capable of distinguishing between these things and wrote that because they're trying, in fact, to block it. I mean, because there's a number of provisions in this existing, you know, I mean, in the main legislative package that they don't like and that they, you know, are trying to block and that there's been, you know, for some time, insurance companies have been as I think, you know, a canny businessman do in these circumstances, kind of playing, you know, both sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
That insurance company money has gone into sort of Tea Party type stuff. Insurance company money has also obviously gone to all the key Democrats here. The head of AHIP has always, you know, positioned themselves as sort of for reform, but I would say.
Yeah, and I'll admit, being right. for reform is a meaningless rhetorical gesture. I'm not putting any weight on that claim by a...
Right. I mean, exactly. I think the point that John and I were both making is that there's been a certain amount of effort, I would say mostly from people on the left, from the the sort of the big
Jane Hampshire, Howard Dean, yeah.
Yeah, to portray the legislation, that exists as... basically, nothing but a subsidy to health insurance companies, which, if it was the case, I mean, obviously there are, in fact, a lot of subsidies to a lot of companies coming out of Washington. Mm-hmm. And, usually the lobbies that benefit from them are, considerably more straightforwardly enthusiastic yes. about them than insurance companies are about this bill.
Well, but let's be clear. I mean, first of all, anything mm-hmm. you say this bill about healthcare, it's not exactly clear. There's a House bill, there's a Senate bill, and there's a rough, vague proposal that was not even detailed enough for a CBO score from the White House. And
well, I would say the White House draft.
And then there's what the state of what the negotiations existed at before the Scott Brown election. So, okay, the
right.
White House draft.
Sure, fair enough.
But that doesn't have that much meat on its bones. So, I mean, I've been writing, obviously, on this theme. I've been the one most regularly writing from the right on the degree to which mm-hmm. the Obamacare stuff can be a corporate giveaway. First, let me say the drug industry, and we'll set that aside. They certainly, in that Senate bill, made out like bandits. And
right.
They
I think we should talk about that.
But let me just quickly
been sort of under discussed.
Yeah, one last thing on the insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
To say part of the problem is that Obama and you and lots of writers like to say reform. And reform, there's a problem that makes it sound like it's getting better, which I don't agree. But B, it's a vague term, and Obama used it for every single incarnation of the bill. So
sure.
to say insurers oppose reform can be a little semantic game. If you define reform the way, the average lefty does, then sure, insurers oppose that. Do they impose everything that's proposed under the name of reform? Certainly they don't impose the individual mandate. They don't even oppose the guaranteed issue and community rating regulations because they propose those together as a package with the individual mandate before Obama was even sworn in. They don't oppose the ramped up subsidies. So are they on the same side as MoveOn.org? No. But are they on the same side as Max Baucus? I think probably so. So are they going to be on the same side eventually as Barack Obama? And now you see we're sort of getting into what I think you said in your blog post today. Who's on what side isn't necessarily uh-huh. the most important thing as much as the substance of the bill. But who's on what
sure.
side is exactly the weapon that the Democrats are going to use in 2010 and that lots of liberal writers have been using as their primary. I mean, Anthony Weiner on the floor of the House said Republicans are wholly owned a subsidiary of the insurance industry, even though Democrats outraised Republicans 2-1 so far this year from the HMO industry. So
right. Right. But so let's pare this back.
Mm-hmm.
Do politicians overstate things? Yes. Is Anthony Weiner a politician? Yes. 100%. Completely. Right on. There you go. At the same time, right, the fact of the matter is, right, that when it comes to the insurance industry, that the proposals that are here, which have come, I mean, you've had two sort of main versions here, where on the one hand, you've had sort of leftier versions of this, which have involved various degrees of public option
mm-hmm.
that insurance companies don't like. And you've also had more centrist versions, which are much friendlier to insurance companies on that side of things, but have included taxes on expensive health insurance plans,
yes.
which insurance companies also don't like. Now,
yes.
you easily could sort of take the Senate vision and take the House vision and put them together into something that's closer to the insurance industry's preferred vision, right? Which would be
yes.
mandate, subsidize, regulate, and
yeah.
get the money for the subsidies from someplace outside the healthcare sector, right? I mean, if you had like a giant tax on iPods and you used
mm-hmm.
that money to subsidize the purchase of
yes.
private insurance, that would be their dream. But there isn't, in fact, such a proposal moving forward. That's what they've been sort of lobbying for, to minimize the regulations on them. And you've seen – I mean, one thing you've seen throughout the public option thing is that the preference from industry is for no kind of change at all, rather than a change that would include that sort of public sector involvement.
I'm not sure that's true. I think it's, I mean, I think they come in with a, they came in with a better negotiating position than Democrats politically, because they are making good profits now, not runaway profits, but the insurance companies are making good profits now. There is sort of a continued threat. A, there's a political threat, and everybody else always focuses on that, I think, too much. This is sort of, you know, goes the historical analogy. We needed FDR, we were going to get communism or something like that. I don't think that's even the main threat. The other threat is just adverse selection is going to keep peeling healthy younger people out of the market. And so the status quo has some real dangers to them. So the individual mandate paired with those regulations addresses that. If the insurance industry could have written a reform,
Well, the mandate addresses it.
Yeah, it would have been the mandate. I mean, together with the guarantee. No, you can't. They wouldn't say no to anybody, and they would limit their price discrimination.
Right.
They would have gone along with that. Right. Even without some subsidies. I mean, with the mandate, you need some subsidy. So that's their health insurance reform right there. And that was a large part of the Senate bill right there. There were parts of the Senate bill they objected to, but that was –
But I mean, so, you know, my sense of this is, right, one thing you have moving forward in all these bills, although they differ on the specific point, is that they mandate a specific medical loss ratio, right, as, as a minimum coming out of the companies. And one thing that's gone on here is that the Congressional Budget Office says that, you know, if you push that medical loss ratio, I guess to explain that that's, you know, how much of the money that comes into the insurance company has to be actually paid out. Of healthcare rather than salaries for the people at the insurance company. And the CBO said that if you push that number up too high, then they score the premiums as taxes, right? And so one thing that the bill writers have all tried to do is sort of keep that premium below that sort of threshold because it makes the bill look cheaper. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, though, insurance companies obviously want the threshold to be low. And my understanding of it is that, you know, part of the concern with this moving forward, you know, is that this would not be – if this bill were to become law, if this set of regulations were to become law, that would not be, you know, the last healthcare law that's ever passed in the United States. And, you know, one thing you see in this debate is that insurance companies are extremely unpopular. And so what everyone wants to do politically is sort of position themselves as against the company. And if you have this kind of regulatory framework in place, then I think it becomes very tempting for politicians down the road to just say, well, we're going to amp up the medical loss ratio issue. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you'll be at that point beyond the sort of concern about, well, we don't want to have a $2 trillion price tag.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's my sense of where it's sort of – I kind of feel like, you know, taking the long run, the insurance companies don't have a very bright outlook either way.
Yeah. No, and I agree. And also – and this is why sort of tactically I think when there was a fun battle on the left ignited by Howard Dean starting to sound like me calling – the Senate bill, the biggest bailout, a bigger bailout for the insurance industry than AIG. There was a fun intramural battle on the left with you and many others on the sort of incrementalism side, and Dean and Jane Hampshire and some of our friends at the Nation, and Glenn Greenwald on the you know, the let's not sell out side. Both sides had valid arguments, but strategically, the reason I think you were right, and this might sort of be a grass is greener observation on my part, so it might be not a little myopic or something, but I think that the left is better at incrementalism, and I think that when you insert government, the sort of it's only the first time that hurts when government sticks itself in somewhere where it hasn't been before. That it's almost impossible to reverse it, in part just because Republicans like talking about limited government, but one of the key rules, and Frederick Bastiat was an economist who talked about this, and Henry Hazlitt as well, there's a problem of what's seen and what's not seen. People are afraid of new threats, of new demons, but when they have something good, even if they're giving up a whole lot to get that something good, it's almost impossible to tell them you'd be better off without that. And on the left, you see the people saying the high cost of low prices. Sure, Walmart's nice, but think about what we're losing because of it. On the right, it's, yes, you may like the fact that we have Medicare when you get old, but think about what we're giving up. You may like the interstate highway system, but where would that money have gone if not for the interstate highway system? And so I think we'd be right in saying we'd be better off without Obamacare, but I also think that would be a harder argument to make 5 years into Obamacare than it is now. So that's why getting the camel's nose under the tent is sort of, yeah, it's a road to single payer.
Right. I mean, I would say the issue is that once something becomes defined as a question of public sector responsibility, right?
Then it's not too, yeah.
Then all kinds of things are on the table as to, well, how do you actually organize it, right?
Yes.
And that the sort of foundational question, right, of like, well, what is the government doing, right? I mean, we say that the government is going to, like, send kids to school. So, you know, the most right-wing option on the table is that, well, the government will send you a check that you can use to send your kids to school, right? But nobody says, well, we're just, like, not going to have schools. And that's sort of the point. I mean, for a lot of people on the left who, you know, favor relatively incremental bill is that the bill contains the fairly radical principle, which exists in many countries but not in the United States, that it's the government's responsibility to ensure that everyone has a certain kind of minimum standard of health care, and that will – I mean, if you look at the precedent of Medicare, right? You know, as you well know, I mean, there's obviously an argument on the right against Medicare, but it's not one that practical politicians, you know, like to
No, and I can make that, and everybody at Reason Magazine and Cato can make that, but no politician running for anything other than a safe Republican House district is going to argue against Medicare.
Right, and I mean, we saw that with the Ryan, Paul Ryan's budget roadmap, which involves sort of voucherizing Medicare, and was, you know, I mean, it was greeted with more fanfare on the left than on the right.
Yes,
because people wanted to say, "Aha! This is secretly the Republicans' plan."
Yeah, but it's not secretly the Republicans' plan. The Republicans don't ever have a sort of long secret plan towards reinstating the free market. In part, that myth is based to some extent on the misperception that I, you know, spent the last 2-3 years of my life trying to pull apart with example after example. It's based on a correct observation that the Republicans, like the Democrats, are way too much in the pocket of big business. But then the next assumption is that what big business wants is some vast open free market in which to run, which is rarely – at most it's the case half the time. And it's often not very much a case. I mean, I think if you're ready to move on, let's use that as a transition to talk about Wall Street. Because Wall Street is a place. It's unlike most other industries. A lot of what big banks' lobbying agenda has been to be left alone. But as you were saying earlier, once the government's already entered into it, it's harder to make that leave them alone argument. And one thing about libertarians – libertarianism is a philosophy that it's a little like Marxism in that it appeals to the very logical, analytical mind. And once things get muddy, there's hardly a libertarian answer. I think that's been the case in banking at least since the FDIC was created. That I think it's misplaced laissez-faire argument to say the federal government should have no say over what banks do with their money, because if I had an insurer insuring me and they said, we're not going to keep insuring you if you continue to do your base jumping, Carney, that's legitimate. And when the federal government is insuring deposits, for the government to come in and say, what you can do with your deposits or in a way that affects your deposits is something we're going to have some say over, that is not outside the bounds. That is not – there's no free market argument against that as long as the FDIC exists. And then the Federal
Although
Reserve –
Although I suppose – I mean, there probably is an argument, right, that the FDIC process could be made more voluntary.
Right? Oh, yeah.
I mean, so you would have to have a universal regulation of some kind that say banks that aren't FDIC have to non-insured banks have to have like a really big sign.
Yeah. And I'd favor the really big sign thing, and maybe they'd offer me better financial products for being out from under the arm of the government.
Right. I mean, I think the question with that, right? I mean, there's a question of, how credible would commitments be to not rescue people, right? I mean, because
yes.
Part of the idea of the FDIC from the get-go was that, well, it insures deposits, but only at certain kinds of institutions and mm-hmm. only up to $100,000. But if it turns out, as it did, that there's a major financial crisis, then actually all kinds of other things are operating with, secret government guarantees.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. That idea, and it was in Paul Krugman's column today, that it's simply not credible to say we're not going to bail things out. It ignores the fact that the bailout in September and October of 2008 could, in fact, have been defeated. And one of the arguments I make in Obamanomics is that Barack Obama was the one man outside of the Bush administration who had the ability to block it. If he had come forward and said, look, we have to do something about this financial crisis, but putting future taxpayers on the hook mm-hmm. for $700 billion of wealth to be given to Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan is not what we're going to do, he could have killed it. So
sure.
It's not well, inevitable. So if, but... Sorry, go on.
No, a couple points on that, right? I mean, one is that if you look at, I think what in popular imagination, the bailout, quote unquote, mm-hmm. was, much more money was used through avenues other than the TARP legislation.
Sure.
Many of which were specifically designed because they were not, because they weren't subject to being blocked, right? I mean, part
they were
of
not subject
they
to
learned
the democratic and, process. Yeah, that's what AIG was about, right? That was the
well,
first
and not just
Wall
AIG
Street.
Though, because this is what I think is actually most interesting about it, right? Is that when the bill passed, which authorized the Treasury Department to do this conservatorship thing with mm-hmm. Fannie and Freddie,
yeah.
It just passed with very little fanfare. Something that a measure that actually turned out to be substantially more costly than TARP.
Mm-hmm.
Also, something which, because it involved Fannie and Freddie, was, closer in a way opposition to the hearts of Republicans who long
yes.
been sort of Fannie and Freddie critics. But the bill came to Congress and it passed, with big margins and support from the leadership of both parties and obviously support from the Bush administration,
mm-hmm.
the endorsement of Ben Bernanke. And that became a sort of tool through which the government has pumped tons and tons of money into the financial system. And to me, I think it illustrates the extent to which, TARP became a sort of political football, which led a lot of people to want to posture against it. But in fact, there's no will to actually stop these things from happening. And you see it most of all in things like John McCain, right, who
yes.
has been doing some weird song and dance over this past
he
week
was
where he's
brainwashed.
Pretending
yes.
he didn't back that.
Well, and I love the analogy to John Kerry in 2004 or something like that. I mean, the support for the Iraq war, because I called the TARP the Gulf of Tonkin resolution or the resolution to authorize the use of corporate welfare on Wall Street. It was, an open-ended thing that these people voted for because they said they had to, and now some Republicans, analogous to Democrats after the Iraq resolution, are saying, well, I wanted there to be a bailout, but I didn't want it to be conducted that way.
What I'll say is actually a little bit strange about some of these TARP regrets is that TARP seems to me to have been a policy that has worked quite well, that certainly the investments that were made in the financial institutions per se, have gotten paid back as that sort of TARP Pollyanna said they would,
mm-hmm.
that the credit spreads have declined a lot exactly as they were supposed to have, that the element of that, which I think really does bear the hallmarks of a giveaway that did not accomplish a great deal, was the use of some of that money into the auto industry. But that's sort of I mean, that doesn't play into the narrative of giveaways to Wall Street. Wall Street actually, you know, it got the money, the panic passed, and now the government is getting money back from Wall Street with profit. And for all the problems that exist in the economy today, the lending channel is working much better. And it seems to be like basically a policy success that I don't know. The universe was different. George W. Bush ought to be claiming this as a victory of his.
I look forward to your three cheers for George W. Bush column soon.
Well, that's like each year.
But here's the thing about the funny thing about bailouts and corporate welfare in general is that they get a much worse rap than they deserve. And I say this as somebody who personally, thoroughly to the end of the day, I detest corporate welfare and bailouts. But I also know that there are a lot of situations where my side, my limited government side, suffers from a rhetorical disadvantage where, you know, I oppose a minimum wage. I don't think there should be a minimum wage at all. I don't think I would ever win a debate of, you know, a crowd of disinterested.
Well, that's because you're in hock to small business.
Yes, exactly. But on the bailout issue, I think the rhetorical edge is unfairly in my advantage, and I love that. I mean, the Chrysler bailout back in the day, that got paid back with full interest ahead of schedule. And these bailouts, much of what was given to Wall Street, some of it, did enable bankers to keep their jobs, who I think probably should not still have jobs. I think anybody who was involved in the decision-making that led to that, and this is where I sound like Ralph Nader, if we're going to bail them out, it should have been every single person working above a certain level there needs to be fired and can't be hired by any of these. But anyway, it's not as much of a theft from the taxpayer as it appears. The economic problems that exist are sort of on a far more complex level. Money that could have gone somewhere else wasn't sent somewhere else. So what's not seen? People were investing their money in Goldman Sachs, like Warren Buffett invested in Goldman Sachs right before the election as on the expectation of a bailout. Maybe he would have invested that money somewhere else. So there's somebody who lost from the bailout. The Federal Reserve creating money out of thin air. To the degree that it kind of gets – I don't understand enough how they make money out of thin air. Do they then eliminate it? I don't know. But that can lead to inflation and interest rates and all that and tax hikes possibly down the line. And so there are serious costs. They're just much more complex. So on the surface, we bailout opponents have the rhetorical advantage. You go down slightly deeper, I agree. It's not as bad as you think, but it's a far more complex, subtle economic thing. I'm not
sure, you know, but I mean, you know, I just, you know, to be clear, I mean, I want to make the strong case. I mean, this problems with the TARP program, sure, but net to net, I think, you know, it was a huge benefit to the United States, and I think that there's a reason that you see that financial panics around the world since the early 19th century have always been resolved through some kind of bailout or other. There's a lot of different ways you could handle it. I mean, it's a sort of generic term, some that work better, some that work worse. The only real exception, right, the only time you really see a government try to just say, all right, let's let the banks fail, was the Hoover administration's approach to the Great Depression. And it obviously worked out very poorly. You know, and I think that small government advocates, to some extent, should look a little bit harder at some of the history of their own ideas. That, I mean, one of the big things that Milton Friedman did, one of his big accomplishments, was to try to say to people, to back up, I mean, the prevailing interpretation, you know, in the 40s and the 50s had been capitalism had been humming along, then this mysterious and horrible depression came, and the only way to fix it was for FDR to come in and sort of bring the United States to a liberal welfare state. Yeah. And Friedman, as part of a, you know, I think largely successful effort to overturn that, said, no. The problems in the Great Depression, though they were very big and somewhat unusual, were basically monetary in nature. And if the Federal Reserve had just expanded the money supply and prevented bank failures, none of this would have happened. in his case, meaning on the one hand, none of this vast unemployment and human suffering would have happened. And also on the other hand, none of this perceived discrediting of the market economy. And so, you know, what you've seen from the European Central Bank and from the Federal Reserve has been and, you know, keep in mind, I mean, Ben Bernanke at the Fed is himself a you know, a free market kind of guy, a right of center economist.
Nobody, just like there are no atheists in foxholes, there are no free market guys in powerful positions in government. It doesn't exist.
Well, you say that, but I mean, I think that may be a mistake. That, I mean, you should look at some of what was done on the monetary side as genuinely an effort by free market guys to take a, you know, limited step to preserve the viability of the basic system of free enterprise.
Well, let me step back and just say on Hoover, I'm going to go home and study what he did on the banks. But I know that the myth that he was broadly a laissez-faire guy is, in fact, a myth. Murray Rothbard.
No. I mean, that's quite right. But I mean, he was very much in favor of allowing banks to fail.
And I mean, but sort of throughout America generally, I mean, we have allowed businesses to fail, and that has been a relative strength of us compared to Europe, for one thing, that they have kept part of the reason. Well, then why did we let Enron fail but not let Goldman Sachs fail if Goldman was going to fail or JP Morgan was going to fail? It's impossible to believe that the unmatched political influence of Goldman Sachs and of Wall Street in general was not a factor in this. In other words, I doubt that it was simply a disinterested consideration on the part of the Bush administration where they just said,
I completely agree with that. But I mean, so to put some nuance into this, right? One question is, why do we treat financial firms separately from non-financial firms?
Yes.
Which I think there are good reasons for. Another issue is why, if a bailout has to be done, why were we so kind to the management of the banks, right?
So that,
for example, right, I mean, when the GM bailout was organized, which, you know, different things. I mean, the GM bailout, I think, was not a good idea. But given that it was done, it was more or less done in the right way, in a way that was quite punitive to the management of the company and got rid of them.
I know lots of people who said a structured bankruptcy like that could have been done for Wall Street, for the banks, that they could have been bankrupted in some way.
Well, I think the idea – well, so I'm saying with the banks, to me, it seems that – quote unquote, bailing them out, which is to say making sure that their debts were paid off so that the financial system kept operating, was a good idea and is something that the Bush administration did primarily because it's the right thing to do. Then it was done in a way that was very friendly to the actual people involved as opposed to just sort of the institutions and the contracts. And that's clearly, I think, because of the political influence of Wall Street, right? That it starts out with Hank Paulson, formerly of Goldman Sachs, implementing this, and it moves on to an Obama administration, which was full of guys who had sort of been on Wall Street and donors from Wall Street. So, you know, those things happen. On the structured bankruptcy thing, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, moving forward, what you want is to have some kind of regulations written down, right? I mean, on the statute books as to how do you put a large financial firm through bankruptcy. Because the consensus is that the existing bankruptcy statute does not function well for financial institutions, which is why the FDIC has a particular process for the banks it insures. But we developed these like Goldman Sachs like behemoths, which the FDIC doesn't cover, which we're not willing to put through Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and which we need to establish a sort of a different structured process. My assessment, though, would be that Congress is not going to do anything about this.
You think there's going to be no sort of – I mean about that specifically or broadly about financial regulation?
Well, really on this – I mean I guess they'll pass some law of some kind. But the outlook for meaningful regulation looks pretty poor to me.
I why do you say that? I mean, you've got Chris Dodd chairing the banking committee who doesn't – I mean, is that what you mean, the way he's opposing, you know, sort of watering it down? Is that
what about? You know, I mean, it's a question of the math, right? I mean, you have, you know, 41 Republicans in the Senate, of whom almost all seem just broadly hostile to regulation. Mm-hmm. You have Chris Dodd, who seems –
very friendly,
lukewarm about this, but has certainly historically been a friend of the industry. And you know, we haven't seen exactly what's you know, the sort of Democrats who you would expect to jump ship from a progressive initiative have not really been making their voices heard on this. But you know, the time will come when it turns out that whatever Chris Dodd and Bob Corker are willing to agree to needs to be further watered down by Blanche Lincoln and Evan Bayh.
And keep in mind, Evan Bayh and Byron Dorgan and Chris Dodd all are keeping their employment options open afterwards. And while I think Dorgan would be better off as an ethanol lobbyist, and Bayh should probably become a drug lobbyist, you don't want to rule out Wall Street. And so, I mean, what is Wall Street?
Well, if you look at Dorgan's record, I mean, he is not going anywhere on Wall Street. He's been
a
rarely bank hostile political figure. But yes, I mean, you have a lot of people who aren't going to be around, and Wall Street has a broader array of post-political career employment opportunities.
Yeah, because you can actually be a banker and not just a lobbyist or something like that. Or be what Rahm Emanuel was and be a consultant at a hedge fund. But also, I mean, I just want to sort of focus into parallel or earlier discussion. What do you think is Wall Street's agenda? Now, obviously, that's a big question because you've got lots of different players with different positions. Goldman Sachs used to not be a bank. They became a bank to be eligible for more Federal Reserve funds. You've got the Bank of America, which has a different setup. You also have smaller banks. You also have hedge funds. So there's lots of different large influential players with different agendas. I don't think what you are not going to see is a big open war against any government involvement and laissez-faire rhetoric coming from the mouths of any of these guys except for, you know, maybe some smaller players. And I don't think you're also going to see a sincere opposition to government involvement, especially because some of what regulation would
What do you mean by government involvement?
Well,
the government's plenty involved.
Yes, but okay, so a new, what you might call reform or a new set of regulations, some of these regulations would provide more certainty about the form that a bailout would take. What does that do? That adds some price certainty.
Right.
When you're looking into your risk, you're saying, okay, here's a percentage of my losing everything, and here's what happens if I lose everything. If you're losing everything, means you could be Lehman, you could be AIG, you could be Goldman. That's a bigger question mark. If it means you're a tier one financial institution and XYZ is going to happen to you, it becomes easier to work out the sort of expected value of some sort of undertaking. So that's one reason. Another thing, regulation always adds a barrier to entry. It always keeps out smaller competitors and makes it more difficult. Another reason why, if you are Goldman Sachs, you don't necessarily oppose regulation. You certainly will oppose many sorts of regulations that many liberals will find desirable, but you don't oppose the broad specter of regulation. And then there's the fact that there are hedge funds whose muscle hasn't fully been flexed and are not a centralized power. They do have a central lobby, but then there's outside influences. There's George Soros, who says, oh, well, I oppose the Volcker Rule. Well, the Volcker Rule makes it harder for people to compete with George Soros.
Right.
And so I think we will get some sort of regulation. I think the point where Obama will be brought out to sort of be the most disingenuous on this, if you go back, I think it was in the State of the Union, he said, I'm not going to sign it. I'm going to send it back unless it's meaningful reform that fixes stuff. I think he will sign it. It will not be meaningful reform that fixes stuff, and that Goldman Sachs and George Soros and J.P. Morgan will all support it. I wanted to predict that here where people can call me out if I'm completely wrong.
That's strong.
Goldman goes
here
down
now.
Tight.
Well, I don't really – well, I don't know. I don't know what the White House is going to do. But, I mean, you know – So, yes, I mean, but I would say this, right? I mean, so there's a few sort of main reform ideas out there that I think are good and that are clearly being opposed by the sort of the major players, right? One is this idea for a freestanding consumer protection agency, mm-hmm. Which looks like, okay, so they've won that fight. The second is the idea for some kind of fee or tax, right? Mm-hmm. So that the way the FDIC works is that, you know, banks pay money day in and day out into the fund, which is then used to pay for the resolution of bank failures. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to say, I mean, a natural analogy would be to say it's not just that we're going to, quote unquote, regulate large banks that have this guarantee, but that they are actually going to pay money. And I think, you know, banks will obviously oppose that. You know, everyone opposes fees being mm-hmm. charged on them.
Yeah.
You're seeing already a lot of opposition to this proposed Volcker rule, which would I mean, there's some disagreement as to how much good it would do, but it would obviously have a meaningful impact on banks' actual operations, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And so that's what you're seeing. I mean, financial institutions are already regulated in theory in a whole bunch of ways. There's this alphabet soup of regulatory agencies. After the thing, all didn't work, there's a lot of momentum behind the idea of reorganizing the agencies. I'm sure there's some version of that that bankers will be happy to sign on to. And you know, that'll be, I mm-hmm. guess, their perspective. And I do think that the real question is, will the White House and the Democratic leadership embrace a very watered-down version of regulatory reform? I mean, it's clear that on health care, right, I mean, they wanted to get a lot done, but were willing to sign on to, you know, almost anything. Right, and say, okay, this is our health reform package. It's good, and that's a strategy. I completely approve of. On financial reform, I think it would really. I mean, I think you could do positive harm by sort of putting a regulatory seal of approval on something that's just a kind of a farce.
And I left out that other reason why business often likes regulation. It's what I call the confidence game. It puts a stamp of approval on mm-hmm. what they're doing, and that's one of mm-hmm. I think again Krugman mentioned that too. He said in his column today, Monday, he said one of the worst things we could do is regulate it, let politicians walk around saying, okay, now finance is safe, go ahead, when it's not. Now, I agree with that criticism, and I just generally think this is almost always what government regulation does. They tell you your cars are safe, they tell you your food is safe, they tell you your finance is safe, they put a government stamp of approval when sort of consumer vigilance, investor vigilance, uh-huh. outside vigilance done by groups like Consumer Reports or whatever is always called for. The government is never going to make investing safe, and that's one of the worst things our government can do. Is tell, I mean, this was a Bush ownership society.
So you don't,
idea.
You don't, but so, but I mean, you really don't think that the existence of like food safety regulations has any positive impact on the quality of the food available?
Has it had a positive impact on? Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's been a positive impact. Is it more positive than what we would have had absent the government playing
right.
this role,
I mean,
or
that's,
centralized
that's what
government
I'm asking.
Role? I don't know. I don't know enough. I don't.
I mean,
think that
I mean,
because
I agree with you, right? I mean, generically, that's a real issue, right? I mean, the ideal point of view for an industry is to have some regulations on it that make it hard for other people to get in.
Yes.
But that don't really restrict that. I mean, so you have formal quota systems, right? I mean, in New York City, if you want to run a cab, you have to have a medallion. And then there's some regulations associated with, you know, what you need to do to be a well-regulated taxi. It's like, you know, your car has to be yellow and so on and so forth.
But the medallion
basically
is
all the rule is
is
doing is keeping competition out, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, no one in that sense is just against quote-unquote regulation.
Yeah. No, but go back and read Gabriel Kolko wrote a book called The Triumph of Conservatism. And what he meant by conservatism mm-hmm. was preservation of the status quo. Had no connection to current modern use of the political mm-hmm. ideology. And he argued that many of Teddy Roosevelt's progressive reforms were simply about that. either trying to make cartels hold together that couldn't hold together, or, and in the meatpacking story, he tells, you know, we all know Upton Sinclair goes and he writes the thing about the workers in the meatpacking factory. Everybody thinks the meat's all gross.
Mm-hmm.
Public upcry for federal regulation. As Colco tells the story, he quotes a head of the American Meatpacking Association, the big company, saying,
mm-hmm.
something along the lines of, we are now and have always been in support of federal regulation of meatpacking. Read what Upton Sinclair said about federal regulation of meatpacking, and he said, no, this was a way for the big guys, paid for by the taxpayers, to get a government stamp of approval. And you read what Teddy Roosevelt said about it. He said, I find Upton Sinclair a completely despicable human being, but in this case, he's driving my goal to get more federal control over here. And like in many of TR's pushes, the smaller guys get squeezed out. And the free market story here is that you could imagine back in 1904 where you buy your meat, it might be where you, from the butcher whom you trust because your dad bought his meat from same butcher. That's this exact guy who gets killed by so many of these regulations. So the free market
regulation
gets killed by government regulation.
Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, I think, you know, to be clear, right, I mean, part of what you're saying in your first book, right, is that, you know, big government, big business, rather, is a kind of bugaboo that
I'm holding up my first book now, The Big Ripoff.
So people like to invoke it, right?
Yeah.
And just be like, oh, big business, I'm against it. So part of what you're trying to show is that a lot of regulatory agendas are actually driven by big business.
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, the same is actually broadly true of small business, right? I mean, so we have a rule in Washington, D.C., which I think is quite common in many American states or municipalities that, you know, you can't sell liquor at a chain store, right?
So and, the corner store can sell booze like while Safeway can in D.C. I think Montgomery County, too, yes.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, all I would say about it is that there's not any – the idea of having regulations does not have a particular valence in one way or another, right? I mean, there's a powerful state apparatus that interests attempt to turn to their advantage.
But I would say that the more it's in Washington, the more the big guys will win. The smaller guys have, I think, an easier time on a lower level, on a state or a county. But also just
maybe
that leads towards whenever a big lobbying debate is opened up, the guys with the better lobbyists are usually going to win. And that will usually be the bigger guys and not the smaller guys. And so that's why I think government intervention in general plays to the advantage of the bigger guys. In addition to the barriers to entry, in addition to the fact that when you have the lawyers and lobbyists, it's easy to comply and tweak the rules. But I'd like to say
it would be interesting to see, you know, empirical kind of scrutiny, because sometimes smaller interests, right, are much more, for example, car dealers have an extremely effective lobby traditionally, precisely because they're so small and scattered and decentralized.
And ethanol has done very well despite not being, you know, a huge presence in the market.
But actually, I mean, what I really wanted to say about that, right, is, I mean, you know, we have in America, probably in other places too, a kind of sentimentalism about smallness, right, versus bigness. But that it's certainly not the correct way to evaluate a regulatory scheme is to say, well, is this good for big players or is it good for small players, right?
Well, except that there are – I mean, just –
I mean, a lot of small – so, I mean, you know, in continental Europe, right, the retail sector, particularly in Germany, is completely dominated by regulations that are you know, aimed at promoting smaller, smaller scale retailers. And, you know, I think most,
and that hurts consumers.
You know, people, probably, I mean, it's a big part of the free market analysis, right, of Europe is to say that, well, their economy would do better if they were less regulated in a lot of these kind of sectors. So I don't know.
You're the guy who's always looking at the, what is the way our Congress and Senate actually work, and how does that lead to these certain outcomes? I wouldn't be surprised if you could come up with a reason why a European system of government can give, and an undue clout, even a damaging clout to the small guys. And, I mean, this right. is one of the great things about being a libertarian is that you don't really have to take sides. You just – I just have to – I mean, I personally, I'm a small, you know, G.K. Chesterton, small town. I like diversity. I don't like walking around Walmart. It freaks me out.
Well, sure,
all that
sure.
stuff. But I don't really have to take sides. I just get to, you know, try to blow the whistle when somebody isn't playing by the rules of the market. And I just what I've
but
seen
so,
over the last
but
hundred
so when
years
people aren't
is
playing
that
by
big
the rules
business
of the market is never right.
Yeah, big business is breaking the rules more, and part of it is a sort of managerial versus entrepreneurial mindset as well, where I think entrepreneurs don't just I said this to Chris Hayes last time I did the blogging head, saying entrepreneurs don't just want to get rich. They want to come in and dominate and remake the world and generally be awesome. And that managers, when you're CEO of a publicly traded corporation, or if you're the people running Walmart now, it's more of the strict fidelity to return on to the investors' value that a lot of people on the left criticize on the corporation. That becomes more present under a managerial system than under an entrepreneurial system, where simple profit isn't the only goal for most entrepreneurs.
I think that makes sense. Should we leave it at that? We've gone a bit beyond what we said we'd do.
Okay, yeah, sounds good. Thank you, Matt.
Okay, it's been fun. Talk to you again.